You're listening to the Hindu Business Line's Field Notes podcast with T.R. Vivek.
Dear listeners, welcome back to another episode of Field Notes, a weekly podcast on all things agribusiness from the Hindu Business Line. I'm your host, T.R. Vivek. At the turn of the century, in the year 2000, ITC launched an ambitious program called eChaupal. Long before agri-tech had become a buzzword, ITC tried to put the tech into agri. At that time, I can personally recall it generated immense excitement and curiosity. Could information technology, computers and internet, all very expensive and aspirational, even for the urban middle-class Indians, be put to effective use for the farmers? Internet kiosks in far-flung villages where even the telephone was a rarity. An online marketplace for farmers was the stuff of science fiction back then. What was the company thinking? In the 21 years since its launch, it's fair to say that eChaupal has had a roller coaster ride, a subject of numerous case studies at prestigious B schools, plenty of positive media attention, and then some tapering off towards the end of the 2000s. Where does eChaupal stand today when it is old enough to go to the bar in ITC Maurya and order a drink? Has the context of Indian agriculture and the regulatory environment completely changed for eChaupal to be relevant even today? To talk about all that, we have with us today S. Shivakumar, the Hyderabad-based group head of agri and IT businesses of ITC. Welcome to Field Notes, Shiva.
Thank you, Vivek. Pleasure joining you on this podcast.
Shiva, take us a bit back in time to 2000s or a few years preceding that and tell us why eChaupal came into being. What were the objectives and what was the problem that ITC was trying to solve?
That's a very interesting thread, Vivek. You know, we were trying to solve one problem, and the idea that we had was solving a second and potentially a bigger problem. And then unless we solve a third problem, we won't be able to meaningfully execute the first two solutions for the first two problems. So in essence, it became an effort to try and solve three different problems. Let me just quickly narrate them as to what they were. You know, late 90s were essentially the time when it was a post-WTO agreement in agriculture. Mid-90s, India was a signatory to agreement, and the world was looking towards a more competitive trade across nations. And obviously, we had to step up India's competitiveness too. And we were looking as to where we can really cut costs and be more competitive. So that was really the first issue in terms of how do you reduce costs along the chain as processors and exporters. We were looking at the essentially farm-to-factory chain in the first instance. And then, of course, there were other similar initiatives from factory intern to port and so on. But in this relevant context, it was farm-to-factory value chain. What are the transaction costs and how can we bring them down to be globally competitive? The second... So then what happened is that the idea that occurred to us was that some of the avoidable costs were because the farmer was going to from village A to a mandi town B, from where we were buying and bringing it to a processing unit C. And so A to B to C was because our farmers were small and quality was quite varying, and one needs to put together for a competitive price discovery and for scale of economy in logistics. So we thought if we could arrange price discovery in the village, the produce can move from A to C directly, and in the process save a lot of avoidable costs. So that was the solution idea. And that was the time, you know, all the internet was becoming common, and globally we had many business models that were occurring, and urban India, we were just about seeing internet, and we said, why not take it to rural? And then when we looked at the opportunity to enable price discovery in the village for the farmer and then move from A to C directly, gave opportunity to solve another problem, which is the need of the buyers, food processors, and customers around the world to look for product integrity. What is the farmer producing? And how do you ensure that the integrity of that product is maintained all through until it actually reaches the consumption. So in the conventional mode of a farmer bringing the produce to mandi, where the produce was getting aggregated before it got transported, obviously the crop of multiple farmers got commingled. And quite often good, bad, ugly is mixed up to ensure that a fair average quality is brought to the next stage in the supply chain. And maintaining product integrity became another opportunity with the same solution. So it was essentially the same solution. Then we saw opportunity to solve a second problem, which then offers us a scope to add value and take it to the consumers. And the third, so now taking it to the ground and executing in the villages with the farmer, all of that meant that if you were just looking at competitiveness within the four walls of an enterprise boundary, then we are only touching the tip of the iceberg. And the real iceberg is in enhancing the competitiveness of the farmers in terms of their own productivity, quality alignment, costs, and all of that. Mm-hmm. And we said, we have to solve the problem for the farmer to be able to then solve the first two problems for ourselves and therefore enhance the overall competitiveness. And that's really how all three got threaded together when we then conceived the whole model and took it to the ground. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Shiva, give us a sense of the size and scale of the initiative when it began, and how did it benefit the farmers and the company? And also give me a sense of what role did your former chairman at that time, Yogi Deveshwar, what role did he play?
Yeah, so we started with the first level of experimentation in about six villages when we started. I mean, like you mentioned in your introduction, it was literally a science fiction. And therefore, whether or not it will work, how it will work, what roles will different stakeholders play, so all of those questions. So one had to start with some level of experimentation. And that's what we had started in 2000 and very rapidly then learned and scaled. And today we reach about 40,000 villages and touch 4 million farmers in terms of the different services that get accessed by the farmers. And so like I mentioned, the third problem, really the benefit that different farmers are gaining is really one, of course, market linkages that one can discover price in the village and therefore a freedom to decide where to sell and more importantly, when to sell. Mm-hmm. See, what happens is that if you're taking the produce to a mandi and then putting up for auction there, already the cost is sunk. And even if you're not happy with the price, you won't bring back your material. Theoretically, you can pull off from the auction. But then that means you are incurring cost twice over. And it won't make sense. So now giving the benefit of discovery in the village for that freedom to decide on when to sell and where to sell. Now there are multiple choices the farmer has, whether I can go to a mandi, I can sell to a village trader, but now with the benefit of information. And a third choice of ITC and so on. So that's the kind of a market linkage benefit. And then leading to, if they were to sell to ITC, and even if you're paying exactly same price as what is being paid in mandi, typically off the transaction cost that the farmer would incur in terms of the transport will still remain the same. Instead of moving from A to B, the farmer is moving from A to C. And then we have to obviously create a network with that level of distance for the villages where we are operating with as clusters. Mm-hmm. And the transaction costs in terms of labor costs, in terms of commission that were being paid out and any other handling losses that were being incurred at these mandis. So these are all typically anywhere between 40 to 50% of the transaction costs that were being incurred were getting saved as a result. This is typically about 2 to 3% of the transaction value or 25 to 30% of the net income of the farm. The other is in terms of if the farmer was producing the desired quality as the market needs. Now, there is a quality factored price. In the village, Ichaupal facilitated required rapid testing equipment to be able to assess things like moisture and other hectoliter weight and other damaged kernels and those kind of content. All the physical parameters that are typically there That kind of equipment helped in more objectively assessing the quality. And therefore, a quality-factored pricing then started incentivizing required varieties and the right quality. That became another benefit, and that typically adds another 2 or 3% of the product price, even for a marginal improvement in quality, because that's what the consumer really values. And a larger benefit is in engagement for productivity enhancement in terms of getting the right weather forecasts and getting the farming practices, the agronomy knowledge, and whatever other inputs that are required for that. And that whole effort then led to productivity enhancement from anywhere between 20% at the lower end to near 100% for some crops. And by virtue of all these kind of benefits, the net incomes of the farmers enhanced in whichever geography that we were operating, whatever crop value chains that we were engaged with. Mm-hmm. And the whole effort also enabled engagement with the farmers on the natural resources. Things like working on water. How do you work on water-saving technologies and efficiency? How do you conserve the topsoil? So all of this also ensured sustainability of the crop production over time. And of course, ITC benefited because this whole model is created in that manner. Mm-hmm. That, you know, we were as small as 350 crores in size when we launched this initiative in 2000. And today, the total agribusiness that goes through this network is 10,000 crores, of course, at current value. Mm-hmm. But that's the kind of a scaling that occurred. Mm-hmm. So that became an all-round benefit in terms of what it meant for the farmers, what it meant for environment, which also is more sustainability angle, and then what the benefit for ITC.
And this kind of engagement also help in the near future for you in terms of launching the FMCG business and a lot of your packaged condiments and the line of staples that you forayed into?
Yeah, certainly the second and the first and second, both of them together problem that I was explaining, more importantly the second and first one is a natural benefit too, is that if you have a identity preserved product available for processing at our food processing units, that gives an opportunity for us to deliver the consumer what the consumer needs. Mm-hmm. A simple example is Ashirwad Atta and the wheat backend. And certainly that helped in every other category like fruit juices or potato-based products and value chains and the other vegetable product that we now have and so on. But just to example, in terms of the identity preservation, how it helps, the typical, while on the face of it appears that atta is an atta is an atta, it's such a simple product. Mm-hmm. But given their own cuisine habits, the cooking habits, the consumer preferences of how atta should be vary across the country in terms of the color, the texture. So let me explain how the value really gets added from an FMCG perspective and how the supply chain product like atta versus what differentiates an Ashirwad atta is that, you know, consumers in different parts of the country, based on their own cuisine and the cooking habits and the practices, and depending on which other dishes they are using, the roti or whatever other forms of bread that they are using it with, have expectations on what should be the color, the texture, the water absorption capacity, or the dough keeping quality, and many such characteristics. Mm-hmm. And each of these characteristics is rendered by different varieties of wheat. And Indian farmers actually grow a host of varieties of wheat at the other end. In the conventional system, whether it was going to mandi and then coming to processor or going to an FCI and then coming into the market, the different variety that the farmers are growing get commingled. And then the identity is lost. And therefore, for an ATA brand to be able to deliver these different properties in a consistent manner for different sets of consumers around the country, then became a challenge. Whereas the identity-preserved supply chain then brought that opportunity. In a very different manner, when you look at B natural juices, for example, most juices typically that are sold in the country are made out of concentrates that are imported. But I said, let's link back to the farmer who produces those fruits or vegetables and then link up so that you have as fresh input as possible that is going in, keeping all the nutrition and so on. And therefore, one had to work at the back end with the farmers to get the right processing varieties and enhance their other properties and so on to be able to then link up. So very similarly in potato and other vegetables and so on. So the supply chain, which is efficient in terms of its costs that each Opal delivers, the supply chain which preserves the identity and extending it further to maintain the traceability back to farm and all the way to the consumption renders itself to value addition. And the fact that one is able to work with the farmer to influence these decisions on what crops and varieties and what farm practice and all that enhances the overall competitiveness of the chain. And that's how the chain certainly helps on an ongoing basis the competitiveness of our packaged foods and other FMCG business also. You also talked about what role did our then chairman, Mr. Deveshwar, play.
Right.
And like I started explaining, it was a science fiction and therefore whether it would work. In fact, that's the plan with which I had gone to say that, no, this is the possibility. We don't have all the answers. And we would like to experiment. And so that's the perspective and opportunity that he saw at that time. And felt that this requires all resourcing and support. And the capital that I had asked at that point of time was 50 lakhs of rupees to do this experiment in the first instance. And quite interestingly, he said, I'll give you 10 crores. And I had no business model to take 10 crores and return on that capital that is expected. But he said, I don't know, if you take 50 lakhs, it's quite likely you'll run into one or the other problem a few months from now. You'll exhaust the 50 lakhs and come back and say the model has not worked. The fact that it's a nice business model with benefits to farmer and to environment wants us to give it a full-blooded try. And don't hesitate if you don't have a business model today. Doesn't matter if it fails. But it should not fail for the lack of financial resource and not completing the whole experiment as may be required. And I think that really enabled me. Eventually, I did end up spending more than 50 lakhs to complete that whole experiment as we had envisaged. By the end of that year, I needed about 2.5 crores. We didn't need all that 10. But so that's a kind of the entrepreneurial, no different from a startup that you would see in terms of how do you really bootstrap, get some more angel investment, in this case, angel really in quotes, and then bring it. And that continues today in terms as we move on to 4.0, how this is visualized, what level of experimentation is, what carried forward. And so today's chairman, Mr. Puri, coming in to then support higher tech, so to say, in this model. So that's the entrepreneurial ways of working of ITC.
Interesting that you recounted the response of Deveshwar. Now you encounter a lot of management buzz phrases like, you know, fire bullets before you fire cannonballs, you know, experiment at a small scale and then scale up organization-wide. It's quite interesting that, you know, he armed you with cannonballs when you were asking for bullets.
Yeah. Absolutely. In fact, the whole model, we had branded the process of evolution as roll out, fix it, and scale up. as in you roll out with the kind of channel that you said, it's not just very controlled inside lab kind of an experiment, because this is a social experiment, live that is occurring, and therefore you need that kind of ammunition. And then obviously there will be issues that you need to correct. And the fix-it component in that process really gives the courage to the whole team to say that, okay, let me experiment. Doesn't matter if a few things don't work, I will correct it before I scale up. And I think that ammunition and the wisdom really helped in institutionalizing this process through the organization.
You know, but it also helps that ITC is a huge cash-rich company at that point of time. So these big bets could have been taken. It's far easier for an ITC to do it rather than a startup, I suppose.
Well, cash, of course, is very important. But, you know, like I said, you deploy cash, there is a return that is expected. So obviously, model and the entrepreneurial courage, like I just saying when you overlap in terms of your follow-through question, the professional entrepreneurialism in terms of preneurial, as we call it, that is equally important. So you actually do it in stages. Okay. It's as important to de-risk and make it modular, notwithstanding cash that is available. So therefore, all of this really make it a holistic kind of environment in which innovation thrives.
Shiva, things like VSAT links, RNS, internet kiosks might now sound alien to people of a younger generation. Given the changes in the communication technology and the regulatory landscape in many states since you started eChopal, how has eChopal itself evolved? Is the model less or more relevant today?
Yeah, technology is one component. Certainly, eChopal evolved. The technology in eChopal kept changing over time. I mean, of course, all of these VSAT that you talked about, desktops, we had to work with solar companies to really get the right solar panels that will work even when there are clouds, and we had to work with battery for battery companies to get the storage right. So I think that that was the stage when we started. But by 2009, when mobile phones started penetrating rural, mobile phones became an integral part of the model. And then as the assisted model in the farms became relevant, the Chopal Pradarshan Care, then Chopal, the farmer field schools that were there, then were assisted by people who are carrying mobile laptops and the other tablet and all of that to be able to assist the farmers on field. And as we moved into the current model of 4.0, it's the microservices architecture, the plug and play of multiple apps into the larger super app that we now have. So I think it obviously kept pace, if not shaped the technology evolution in models like this. But let me also point out, because obviously the e-preface always is that it's tech that comes top of mind. But as important are a few other aspects in a model, and then how model is continuing to remain contemporary and if not even more relevant today than ever before. The second piece is the human engagement in the form of the institution that got created, the Sanchalaks and the Samyojaks, the relationships and the trust that gets built. The social capital is as important as the technology infrastructure. So while technology kept evolving and changing, and one had to really shape it and keep pace with it, the human perspective and the trust and relationships really kept getting reinforced, and that only gets enhanced. That's a second very critical piece, whatever that we want to add on into the business scope or other methods of modifying this that were part of it. The third piece, in some sense, is the point that we were just discussing a little earlier on the ITC's FMCG businesses and the back-end angle. The value chains and the brands anchoring the entire backend, and each value chain is different in terms of its dynamics and scope, and therefore create the models which are nuances are very different for different crops. The wheat model that I explain and the fruit or vegetable model that I explain, in itself, they are very different in terms of how the value is really created for all the stakeholders and then captured for us to then build on this model. And therefore, that appreciation of the nuances, not just seen as one Indian agriculture, but the various nuances, that helps keep the model robust as it evolves for different kind of crop allocation. And the last piece is on the partnerships. To complete delivery of a competitiveness enhancement for a farmer, you need weather forecasting companies, you need remote sensing companies, you need input companies, you need financial services companies, and you need government agencies who are providing insurance and all of those kinds of things which come together. And along the journey of each Opal, the scope of partnerships also kept evolving. In the 1.x series, as we call, it is value chain re-engineering as relevant for different kind of crops. Role of partners was in really in the logistics and quality evaluation, demand signals getting transmitted back to the farmers and those kind of things. In the 2.x series, the whole infrastructure that was put up in 1.x was seen as a platform. And that platform enabling similar kind of services and products going back into the villages. Also, as a reverse flow that it could support. And therefore, whether it was agricultural extension and the farm inputs and financial service and even consumer goods distribution, organized retail in rural Eta, the Chopal Sagar, the service centers. So that really was the evolution in the 2.x series. So then we moved to a 3.x series where some of these partners, together with them, it became an ecosystem, and that ecosystem was offered as a service to the fourth parties, whether it is for the brand building in rural India or whether it is farm equipment, Uberized services for hiring and making use of, or for many of the social investments of ITC in terms of the water, climate smart villages. So for all of this, the ecosystem as a service, the 3.x series model is what really meant. So now as we are grounding the 4.0 after a significant amount of piloting and experimenting over the last 2 years, we are creating a meta market. I refer to the microservice, and here also the partners really plug and play. It's more high tech. The super app, we now called it ITC Mars, the meta market for advanced agriculture and rural services as the acronym. And then the FPOs coming in and joining from the other side of the physical, so that the physical model continues to evolve. So I think that's the kind of a evolution that kept pace, not only on technology front, but also on the human engagement to the new institutions like Sanchalaks and all that we created, as also the anchoring by value chains and our own export business and the scope of partnerships as it evolved. I think in this holistic frame is how the model has pivoted four times over in these 20 years.
Shiva, interesting to note that the three problems that you listed out that you were trying to solve for at the turn of the century, the same issues seem to be relevant even today. You know, we are still talking about such issues. And today there are many new companies and startups that are claiming to be again solving for the same problems of fragmentation, market access, or information services, and wanting to become platforms. Do you see them as sort of legacies of the ITC model? And is there enough business in the market for all of them to succeed? What is your view on the new wave of agri-tech companies and platforms?
So in a sense, your question had the answer also.
Okay.
The problems are still relevant today. So to that degree, one has to solve. So like I said, currently we reach about 4 million farmers. There are 120 million farmers in India. And even if you look at market-oriented farmers, the half of them is 60 million. And assuming the other 60 million farmers are reached through various social investments and those kinds of things, and government interventions and all of that, and as well as the trickle effect of these business models, the problems that need to be solved for many more farmers and for many more crops. So to that degree, different set of players, whether it is the new ag tech or it is conventional companies integrating tech, and each of them come from a different vantage point and try and solve one or more problems from their own perspective. It is a tech forward or it is a value chain backward integrating tech, any which way it is done. So therefore, in that sense, the large scope that exists gives enough and more space for many more players. Mm-hmm. You know, today, agriculture is nearly a half a trillion economy out of our 2.7 trillions, including all the allied products like milk and forestry and some of that. And India's own aspiration is to get to 5 trillion in the medium term. And agriculture has to get to about $1 trillion in that. Mm-hmm. Now, for us to move from this half a trillion to that trillion, and in a manner which increases farmer incomes and expands our exports and serves the Indian consumers with what they are seeking in the process, deal with our food security and nutrition security, and more importantly, solve problem of water depletion, topsoil, and deal with big issue of climate change. I think the space is really very, very large and complex. So it takes all hands on the deck. And so everybody has a space. And therefore, it's not so much in terms of one versus the other, as much as one and the other together. Mm-hmm. Like I said, the meta market model that we now have in 4.0 is a plug and play with microservices. It has a host of startups, ag tech players who have point solutions mm-hmm. that get integrated today far more seamlessly than we have been able to do in the 2.x series model. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the way forward. I think there is both a need as well as an opportunity for everybody to join this.
Sure. Finally, Shiva, what according to you is the lasting impact in these 21 years since eChopal came into existence of the model? Are there any lasting structural changes that eChopal could claim credit for?
I mean, that's a great question, Vivek. You know, typically people look at transactions and stop at transactions. Okay, well, that is in itself big and important, how much income has gone up to the farmer and what business expansion has it happened to ITC and what other sustainability goals it has been able to accomplish, all of which we talked about. But I think it's very, very important, given the dimensions I just mentioned in response to your earlier question, to also look at the more structural contributions that ITC eChopal possibly made, I mean, at least from the way I look at it, is that you know, there are many other things that it did, but let me just recount three of them. You know, there is the importance of freedom of choice for the farmer, the alternative marketing channels. ITC eChopal came in at a time when mandi was the only option for the farmer to take the produce and sell. The only other thing that farmer was doing was at best selling off to a village trader if the farmer was not able to take the produce all the way to mandi. Mm-hmm. It was so small and so on. And then with no second option, village trader also exploited with whatever price that one could offer. So from an era of that to a situation where you say their choices help farmers exercise them, and therefore bargaining power gets enhanced, and alternative marketing channels are very, very important. So all the subsequent reforms in the agricultural marketing laws, starting with the very first amendment, which was done at that point of time to enable eChopal to actually operate, to a series of things that different states and the center have then enabled, is that underlying spirit that the farmer should have a freedom of choice, and the choice really will help, is something that ITC eChopal has been able to demonstrate as a very, very important kind of thing. The other is that conventionally, you know, like one were to say a BC as a before Chaupal and after Chaupal, the conventional engagement with the farmers of rest of the ecosystem has typically been, if I am a buyer of output, I am only interested in the buying transaction. If I am a seller of input, I am only interested in the selling transaction. If I am delivering extension services as a government employee, then I just provide that. And if I am a bank, I am just providing a loan, and so on. So this piecemeal engagement with the farmer getting transformed into an integrated engagement is something that I believe we have pioneered in crops which are open-ended. They were closed-loop crops like sugarcane, where sugarcane industry always engages the farmer holistically. As seed production farmers, seed companies engaged holistically. So in specialty crops, what was possible in limited catchments and geographies, but to create a market business model in a manner that it is possible to engage with the farmers in an integrated fashion, and that's what creates value on a multi-stakeholder base. I think that is the second important structural change that today you find many companies, not-for-profits, governments engaging and doing it in an integrated fashion. And then lastly, I think even at a broader level, it is certainly in agriculture, but even at a broader level, the engagement of business enterprises in developing their value chains, that you can actually create models in which you can make them inclusive. I think that effort really has inspired many others to look at inclusive value chains across different kind of.
What do you mean when you say inclusive value chains?
So typically, the supply chain engagement between one player and another in normal course is like a zero-sum game. That if I squeeze out from my supplier, that's when my buying cost is lower. That's why I enhance my profit. And supplier will say that unless I extract a higher price from my customer, I don't gain more income. And so is the case with, and that's what happened in the traditional agricultural chain, because series of intermediaries acting as principals to transaction. And then their whole chain became opaque. The demand signals never reached the farmer, and the product integrity was never maintained by the time it reached the consumption. The kind of problem that I explained in a different context. Now, in an inclusive value chain, where I become more profitable as a business only by enhancing profitability of the farmer, and both of us can sustain our profits only if we contribute to environment in terms of water and topsoil and making the climate resilient and so on. So that really becomes inclusive, that if you are only doing as a zero-sum game with one side gaining, it is really excluding other stakeholders in the whole chain. Even when I bring in a farm input company or a weather forecast company into it, as to how do I create business models for them and improve their own profitability. So that really is how you become inclusive. So I think that's the an important lasting contribution that, you know, around the time that we were doing it, the phrase that became very popular by late C.K. Prahlad coining it, was profit at the bottom of the pyramid. So it is like, yeah, there is a bottom of the pyramid. I go and look for my profit. Versus an inclusive model is where you say that profit, yes, indeed, there is their fortune at the bottom of the pyramid. But in the first instance, I need to enhance the profit of these low-income people to be able to participate in that.
Expand the cake for everyone rather than, you know, hankering for a bigger share.
And so intertwining, absolutely. Intertwining the upside for the farmer who has a weak bargaining power otherwise with the business objective of the corporate and similarly other partners who come in. I think that is another contribution to the whole evolution of this thinking. Is what I believe.
Thank you, Shivakumar, for joining us on Field Notes. And until we meet next week, goodbye and God bless.
Thank you, Vivek. I enjoyed chatting with you.